wolfishly. "There," he said and pointed. "But you can't go to him now."
"Why not?"
"Because your brother is fighting that Tatar Chelubey in single combat.
Didn't you know?"
She whipped around, horrified. But it was too late. Already too late. The armies were drawn up, and now two figures appeared from each side, riding toward each other, on a gray horse and a chestnut.
"You knew and waited to tell me," she said.
"I may serve you," said the bear.
"I may even enjoy it, but I will never be trustworthy. Besides, rather than talk to me before, you spent the night arguing with my brother who, no matter how blue-eyed, cannot know the army like I do. Your loss."
Pojar threw her head up, sensing Basia's sudden urgency. She said, "I must go to him," just as the bear hurled himself snarling in her way.
"Are you a fool?" he demanded. "Do you think there is no man out of all of them with the wit to see you or that golden horse? Can you rely on it when all eyes will be fixed on your brother? Can you be sure that no Tatar will raise no cry of treachery?"
And seeing Vasya staring at him, stone-faced, frozen, he added,
"The monk will not thank you. That Tatar tortured him. He is doing it for Dmitri, for his country, for himself. It is his glory, not yours."
She turned round, indecisive, agonized. They were all drawn up, the armies of Rus and the armies of Mamai, and shivering in the dawn mist, their mail cold and heavy. Among them were the powers that no one could see. The Vodyanoi of the dawn, waiting to drown the unwary. The Lieshi of the woods, concealing men in his branches. The grinning king of chaos. The lesser charity of wood and water. And unseen, powerful, aloof, the king of winter. He was in the clouds in the north, the hard, chill wind, the occasional snowflake on her cheek, but he would not come down and stand among them. He would not fight Dmitri's war. She had seen the terrible knowledge in his eyes. "My task is with the dead." "I could be far from here," Vasya thought, seeing her hands tremble. "I could be far away beside the lake, or at Lesnaya Zemlya, or in a clean forest with no name. Instead, I am here. Oh, Sasha, Sasha, what have you done?" Alone, Brother Alexander rode onto the swampy field of Kulikova, rode between the spears of Dmitri's vanguard, and out into the open space between the two armies. There was no sound but Tuman's soft snorting breath and the suck of her hooves in the sodden earth. A man on a tall red horse rode out to meet him. More than 100,000 men on that field, and still it was quiet enough for Sasha to hear the wind rising, sighing as though in sorrow, blowing down the last of the leaves.
"A fair morning," said Chelubey, sitting easily on his stocky Tatar horse.
"I am going to kill you," said Sasha.
"I think not," said Chelubey. "In fact, I am sure not. Poor holy man, with the scars on your back and your torn hand."
"You cheapened this," said Sasha.
Chelubey's face was grim now.
"What is this to you? A game? A spiritual quest? It is only men against men, and whichever side prevails, there will be women wailing and blood on the earth."
Without another word, he wheeled his horse around and cantered a few paces away, turned, and stood waiting. Sasha did likewise. Still, all was silent. Strange, in all that gray morning, with men in the 10,000s waiting. Once more he thought he glimpsed a single horse glowing gold in the last of the mist, a slender rider on her back. At her side was a hulking black shadow. He breathed a silent prayer. Then Sasha raised his spear and shouted, and at his back came a roar from 60,000 throats. When had the Rus last come together? Not since the days of the Grand Princes of Kiev. But Dmitri Ivanovich had drawn them together, there on the cold bank of the River Don. Chelubey shouted in turn, his face bright with joy, the sound of all his people shouting at his back. Tuman stood steady beneath her rider, and at Sasha's touch, she shot forward. Chelubey kicked his powerful chestnut, and then they were racing across the marshy ground, mud and water flying from beneath their horses' hooves. Vasya watched them gallop, her heartbeat strangling fast in her throat. Their horses threw great arcs of mud with each stride. Chelubey's spear dipped at the last moment to catch her brother in the breastbone. Sasha's shield deflected the full force of the blow. His own spear rattled along the scale on Chelubey's shoulder and broke. Vasya put her hand to her mouth. Sasha dropped his broken spear haft and drew his sword just as Chelubey wheeled his chestnut, icy calm. The Tatar still had both his spear and his shield. He guided his mare with his knees. Sasha's sword had less than half his reach. A second pass. This time, at the last instant, Sasha touched Tuman's side. The quick-footed mare feinted left, and Sasha's sword came down on Chelubey's spear haft. Now they were both armed only with swords, and wheeling their horses once more. Now it was close work, striking, feinting, drawing back. Even from a distance, the ringing of their swords came clearly to her ears. The bear smiled with pure unfeigned joy, watching. Chelubey's chestnut mare was a little quicker than Tuman. Sasha was a little stronger than Chelubey. By now, both men had mud on their faces, dirt and blood on the necks of their horses, and they grunted each time their heavy swords struck. Vasya's heart was in her mouth, but she couldn't help him, nor would she. This was his moment. His teeth were bared, and in his face was glory. Her palms were bloodied with the impress of her nails. Fine snow stung her face. Vasya could hear the voices of Cherti rising too, and also the voices of Russians, calling encouragement to her brother. Sasha parried another thrust and scored a strike along Chelubey's ribs, tearing away the chain mail. Chelubey blocked a second blow with his sword, and then the two men had their swords pressed hilt to hilt. Sasha did not falter. He heaved with all his strength and threw Chelubey out of the saddle. The bear roared when the Tatar fell, and all the men on both sides screamed out. Chelubey and Sasha were grappling in the dirt, swords gone, only their hands and fists now. Then Sasha's hand, groping, found his dagger. He buried it to the hilt in Chelubey's throat. All around, the Russians shouted victory. All of Vasya's Cherti cried out likewise. Sasha had won. Vasya let out a shaken breath. The bear sighed as though in the most profound satisfaction. Sasha stood straight, his bloody sword in his hand. He kissed it and lifted it to heaven, saluting God and Dmitri Ivanovich. Vasya thought she heard a single voice, Dmitri's voice, calling to his men. God is on our side. Victory is sure. Ride now. Ride. And then the Russians were charging, all of them, massed, screaming the name of the Grand Prince of Moscow and of Alexander Peresviet. Sasha turned straight back, as though to call to his horse and join the charge, but he didn't call. The bear turned to look at Vasya, his eyes eager and intent, and then Vasya saw it, the great rent in Sasha's leather armor, where a sword thrust had found its mark, unseen in the melee. No! Her brother turned his head as though he could hear her. Tuman had come back to him, and he put a hand to the pommel of her saddle, as though to vault to her back. Instead, he fell to his knees. The bear laughed. Vasya screamed. She did not know such a sound was in her. She leaned forward. Pojar shot forward, raced across the open field toward Sasha, outstripping the converging armies. The bear followed her. Faintly, she could hear the voices of the Cherti of Rus running with the Russians. But Vasya had stopped thinking of victory. On either side, the armies were rushing up, but in the middle of the field, there was nothing but Tuman, wild with fright, and Chelubey dead, face down in the mud and water. Vasya had no thought to spare for either, for her brother was still kneeling in the mud, but shaking violently now, the blood spilling from his lips. He looked up. "Vasya," he said. "Shh," she told him. "Don't talk." "I am sorry. I meant to live. I did." Pojar silently knelt in the mud for them. "You're going to live anyway. Get on the horse," Vasya said. She had no notion of how it must have hurt him to obey her. The ground shook from the thunder of two armies. He could not sit upright, but slumped, dead weight.
"He is going to die," said Medved at her side. "Better to take vengeance."
Without a word, Vasya gashed her hand on her brother's sword. Blood poured over her fingers. She smeared it across the bear's face, putting all she had of will in it.
"Take vengeance for me," she said flatly.
The bear shuddered with strength. His eye blazed up, brighter than Pojar at midnight. Watching her, he snatched Sasha's helm off the muddy ground and bit deep into his own hand. Blood poured down, clear as water, but acrid with the smell of sulfur, pooling in the cup bronze.
"I give you my power in exchange," he said, and his glance was sly, "to make the dead rise."
Then he was gone, disappearing into the fray, terror his weapon. Vasya, balancing the helmet, got up onto Pojar behind her brother. The mare, ears pinned, stood up despite her double burden, mud on her legs and belly. Fast as a star, she galloped away, while all around them the battle was joined. Chapter 35. The Starlit Road. Vasya could feel every strike of Pojar's hooves, as though she were the one mortally wounded. The mare twisted and turned, avoiding armies and Cherti both. Once she jumped clean over a dead horse. All the while, Vasya gripped her brother, gripped the helmet with its strange burden, and she prayed. At last they broke clear of the battle and left the omnipresent roar behind them, concealing themselves in the trees that lined the river. They found a space of quiet in a little copse. They were not terribly far from the battle. The roaring seemed to shred the earth and sky. Vasya thought she could hear the bear laughing. The copse was a little higher than the marsh. Vasya slid from Pojar's back just in time to catch her brother as he fell. He almost sent her sprawling into the water. It took all her strength to halt him and lay him on the soft earth. His lips were blue, his hands cold. She stared at the water in the helm.
"Make the dead alive, but he isn't dead.
Morozko, Morozko, where are you?" Sasha's eyes looked up, but they did not see her. Perhaps he saw a road beneath a starry sky, a road from which there is no turning back.
"Vasya," he asked.
His voice was little more than a breath now. She had nothing but her two hands. With her fur cloak, she wiped the blood and earth from her brother's face, held his head in her lap.
"I am here," she said.
Tears unbidden spilled from her eyes.
"You have won. The army is sure of its victory."
His eyes brightened.
"I am glad," he said.
"I am..." He turned his head a little. His stare became fixed. Vasya turned to follow his gaze, and there was the death god, waiting. He was on foot, his horse a faint shape, pale as mist at his back. She looked at him long, and there were no words between them. Once she had begged, once she had railed at him for coming to claim those she loved. Now she only looked and saw her glance go through him like a sword. "Could you have saved his life?" she whispered. His answer was the merest shake of his head, but he came, still wordless, and knelt beside her. Frowning, he cupped his hands. Water, clear and clean, gathered in his palms, and he let it trickle out onto her brother's face. Where the water touched, the cuts, bruises, the grime vanished, as though washed away. Vasya, not speaking either, helped him. They worked slowly and steadily. Vasya pulled aside the stained and broken armor, and Morozko let the water run. In the end, her brother's face and torso were clean and unmarked. He looked asleep, peaceful, unwounded. But he did not stir back to life. She reached for the helmet. Morozko's troubled glance followed the movement. Hope was beating in her throat, a fragile, burning thing. "Can this bring him to life in truth?" Morozko looked reluctant. "Yes," he said. Vasya lifted the helmet, tipped it toward her brother's lips. Morozko put out a hand to stay her. "Come with me first." She did not know what he meant, but when he offered her his hand, she took it. Their fingers met, clasped, and she found herself in the place beyond life, the forest with its road, its net of stars. Her brother was waiting for her there, upright, a little pale, starlight in his eyes. "Sasha," she said. "Little sister," he said. "I didn't say goodbye, did I?" She ran forward and embraced him, but he felt icy cold, distant in her arms. Morozko watched them. "Sasha," Vasya said eagerly, "I have something that will bring you back. You can live on. Come back to us, to Dmitri." Sasha was looking out into the distance, down the star-strewn road, as though with longing. Hastily, she said, "This," holding out the dented helmet. "Drink it," she said, "and you will live again." "But I am dead," he said. She shook her head. "You need not be." He was backing up. "I have seen the dead return. I will have no part in it." "No," she said. "It is different this way. It is like Ivan in the fairy tale." But her brother was still shaking his head. "This is not a fairy tale, Vasya. I will not risk my immortal soul returning to life when I have left it." She stared at him. His face was quiet, sad, immovable. "Sasha," she whispered. "Sasha, please, you can live again. You can go back to Sergei and Dmitri and Olga, please." "No," he said. I fought. I yielded my life, and I was glad to give it. It is for others to make it matter. My death is Dmitri's now, and yours. Guard this land. Make it whole." She stared at him. She could not believe. Wild thoughts darted through her brain. Perhaps in the living world, she could force the water between his lips. But then, it wasn't her choice. She thought of Olga's rage when Vasya had decided the same question for her. She remembered Morozko's words, "It is not your choice to make." Trying to control her voice, she said, "Is this what you want?" "It is," said her brother.
Then God be with you," said Vasya, her voice breaking.
If you see father and mother, tell them I love them, that I have wandered far but not forgotten. I will pray for you.
And I for you, said her brother, and smiled suddenly. I will see you again, little sister. She nodded but could not speak. She knew her face was crumbling, but she embraced her brother. She stepped back. And then Morozko spoke softly, but his words were not for her.
Come with me, he said to Sasha. Do not be afraid.
Chapter 36 The Army of Three. She tumbled back to herself, bowed over her brother's unmarked body, sobbing. She did not know how long she wept, while the battle raged nearby. It was a soft hoofbeat that drew her back and a cold presence behind her. She turned her head to see the Winter King. He slid from the back of his horse and looked at her. She had no words for him. Gentle speech or a soft touch would have shattered her, but he offered neither. Vasya shut her brother's eyes, whispered a prayer over his head. Then she got to her feet, soul full of restless violence. She could not bring her brother back. But the thing he had wanted, the thing he had worked for, that she could do. Only for the dead, Morozko, she said. She reached out a hand, still smeared with her brother's blood and her own, from where she'd cut it for the bear. He hesitated. But in his face was an echoing savagery. He looked suddenly like he had on a midwinter midnight, proud, young, dangerous. There were traces of Sasha's blood on his hands, too.
And for the living, beloved, he said low, they are my people, too.
He caught her bloody hand in his, and all around the wind shrieked. The cry of the first snowstorm. Her soul was all restless fire, and when she looked up at Pojar, the golden mare was drawn equally taut. She pawed the ground once. They mounted their horses together and wheeled and galloped back to the battle on the breast of a newborn storm. Flames in her hands, in his grip, was the power of bitterest winter. A shout came from the field as the bear, laughing, caught sight of them.
We must find Dmitri, called Vasya, shouting over the noise, as she sent Pojar hurtling through a knot of Tatar warriors who were galloping down a group of Russian pikemen.
The beasts scattered with sudden fright, spoiling their swearing riders' aim. A swift wind leaped up and blew wide an arrow that would have struck her. And Morozko said, there is his standard. It was at the apex of a small rise, in the first line of battle. They turned thither, cutting a swath through fighting men as they did. The snow was falling thicker and thicker now. A hail of arrows was targeting Dmitri's position. A wedge of horsemen was pushing through, trying to get to that vulnerable banner. The white mare and Pojar, light on their feet, cut through the battle faster, but the Tatars were closer and it was a race between them. Ears flat to her head, Pojar dodged and sprang and galloped while Vasya shouted at the Tatars' horses. A few heard her and faltered, but not enough. The ground under the enemy's feet grew slippery with ice, but the Tatars' horses were sturdy beasts, used to running on all surfaces, and even that didn't sway them. Snow blew in their faces, blinding the riders, but still the skillfully timed arrows flew. Medved! Vasya shouted. The bear appeared on her other side, still with that edge of shrieking laughter in his voice.
Such joy! He crowed.
He was a beast, bathed in men's blood and howling with delight, stark contrast to Morozko's gathered silence on her other side. Together, the three of them made a wedge of their own and bowled through the fighting.
Vasya set fires at their feet, swiftly smothered by the wet field, the fast-falling snow. Morosko blinded them, turned their arrows with a pranking wind. Miedved simply terrified all in his path. It was a race between them and the Tatars to see who could get to Dmitri's position first. The Tatars won. Arrows flying, they slammed into Dmitri's standard like a wave, a few strides before Vasya and her allies. The standard fell, crumpled to mud. All around were shouts of triumph. Still, those arrows fell, deadly accurate. The white mare was hanging close to Pozhar's flank. Most of Morosko's efforts were spent to keep arrows from Vasya and the two horses. Dmitri's guard was smashed apart. His horse reared and went over. Then three Tatars were on him, hacking. Vasya shouted, and Pozhar slammed into them with brute force. Who needed a sword riding the golden mare? Her hooves shattered them, drove off their horses. Sudden fires leaped up at their feet, and they were flung back. Vasya slid down the mare's shoulder and knelt at the grand prince's head. His armor was hacked. He was bleeding from a dozen wounds. She pulled off his helmet. But it wasn't the Grand Prince of Moscow at all. It was a young man she didn't know, dying. She stared. "Where is the Grand Prince?" she whispered. The young man could hardly speak. Blood bubbled between his lips. He looked up at her with unseeing eyes. She had to bend near to catch the words. "The van," he whispered. "The first line of battle. He gave me his armor so the Tatars would not know him. I was honored. I was..." The light faded from his eyes. Vasya closed them, turned. "The line of battle," she said. "Go!" Tatars everywhere, fighting. Arrows flying from all sides. Morosko was riding knee to knee with Vasya, keeping arrows from her with grim tenacity. With the bear, they cut through battles when they could, bringing snow, fire, terror. "The line is wavering," put in the bear conversationally. His eye still glittered, his fur spiked with blood. "Dmitri is going to have to..." Then she heard Dmitri's voice, undimmed, hail, roaring out over all the clash of armies. "Fall back," he cried. "That is not ideal," said the bear. "Where is he?" said Vasya. She could hardly see through the snow and the thrash of fighting men. "There," said Morosko. Vasya looked. "I can't see." "Come on then," said the Winter King. Shoulder to shoulder, they fought their way through the press. Now she could see Dmitri, still mounted, dressed in the armor of an ordinary boyar, his sword in his hand. Whooping, he ran a man through, used his horse's weight to boost another man out of his saddle. There was blood on his cheek, his arm, his saddle, and the neck of his horse. "Fall back!" The Tatars were advancing. All around, the arrows flew. One grazed her arm. She barely felt it. "Vasya!" snapped Morosko, and she realized her upper arm was bleeding. "The Grand Prince has to live," said Vasya. "All this is for naught if he dies." And then Pozhar was level with Dmitri's horse, rearing, forcing another attacker back. Dmitri turned and saw her. His face changed. He leaned over and seized her arm, heedless of her wounds or his. "Sasha," he said. "Where is Sasha?" Battle had numbed her, but at his words, the fog around her mind thinned a little, and beneath it was agony. Dmitri saw it in her face. His own whitened. His lips firmed. Without another word to Vasya, he turned to his men again. "Fall back! Join the second line! Bring them up!" It wasn't orderly. The Russians were breaking, fleeing, hiding themselves in the second line of battle, which was wavering badly. Now the bear was nowhere to be seen, and... Dmitri said, turning back on her suddenly, "If Oleg was planning to take a hand,
Now is a good time.
I'll go find him, said Vasya. To Morozko, she said, don't let him die.
Morozko looked as though he wanted to swear at her. There was mud on his face, too, and blood. A long scratch marred the neck of his mare. He wasn't the aloof Winter King now, but he only nodded, turned his horse to keep up with Dmitri. Dmitri said,
if Oleg hasn't betrayed us, tell him to fall in on Mamai's right flank.
And then he whirled away, calling more orders. Vasya turned Pozhar, trying to sink once more into invisibility, cutting through the advancing Tatar line in search of Oleg. She found the men of Ryazan fresh, waiting on a small rise, watching.
This, said Vasya, riding up to him, is not generally what is meant when you take an oath to a grand prince that you are going to fight.
Oleg just smiled at her.
When one is risking everything on a hammer stroke, one waits until the stroke does the most good.
He looked over the field.
That time is now. Ride down with me, witch girl.
Hurry, said Vasya. He called an order. Vasya wheeled Pozhar. The mare was glowing coal hot, but Vasya couldn't feel it. The men of Ryazan, shouting, raced down the rise at full stretch. Horns were blowing. Vasya fell in beside Oleg's stirrup, going to a little trouble to hold Pozhar to the pace of the racing horses. She saw the Tatars turning in shock to meet an attack on an unexpected quarter, and then she saw another movement from the woods on Dmitri's left flank, Vladimir's cavalry coming out of the forest at last, and the bear among them, driving their horses on with a speed of terror. She could hear his whooping laughter. And so they caught the Tatars between them, Oleg, Vladimir, and Dmitri, and smashed the line to pieces. But still it had to be fought out, hour by bloody hour, and she did not know how long it had been. Hours? Days? When at last a voice brought her back to herself.
Vasya, Morozko said, it is over. They are fleeing.
It seemed a haze fell from her sight. She looked around and realized that they had met in the middle, Oleg, Vladimir, and Dmitri, and also she, the bear, and Morozko. Dmitri was half fainting from his wounds. Vladimir supported him. Oleg looked triumphant. All around she saw only their own men. They had won. The wind had dropped. The early snow fell steadily now, lightly, silently, thickly. It covered dead enemies and dead friends alike. Vasya just stared at Morozko, stupid with shock and weariness. A thin curtain of blood ran down from a scratch in the white mare's neck. He looked as weary as she, and as sad. Dirt and blood on his hands. Only Pozhar was unwounded, still as sleekly powerful as she'd been that morning. Vasya only wished she could say the same. Her arrow-grazed arm throbbed, and that wasn't even close to the pain in her soul. Dmitri had forced himself upright, deathly pale, and was walking over to her. She slid down Pozhar's shoulder and went to meet him. You have won, she said. There was no emotion in her voice. Where is Sasha? Said the Grand Prince of Moscow. Chapter 37 Water of Death, Water of Life. Dmitri's men chased their foes all the way back to Messia, nearly 50 versts. Vladimir Andreevich, Oleg of Ryazan, and Mikhail of Tver led the rout. The princes riding side by side like brothers, and their men mingling like water, so that the eye could no longer tell who was from Moscow, or Ryazan, or Tver, for they were all Russians. They took the herds of Mamai's train,
and killed the puppet Khan he'd brought. They sent the general himself fleeing to Kaffa, not daring to go back to Sarai, where his life would be forfeit. But neither the Grand Prince of Moscow nor Vasya took part in the rout. Instead, Dmitri followed Vasya to a little sheltered copse not far from the river. Sasha lay where they'd left him, wrapped in Vasya's fur cloak, his flesh clean in violet. Dmitri half fell, stumbling from his horse, and caught his dearest friend's body in his arms. He did not speak. Vasya had no comfort for him. She was weeping, too. A long silence fell in that copse as the long day ended, and the light grew smoky and insubstantial. Snow still fell softly all around. Finally, Dmitri raised his head. "He should be taken back to the Lavra," he said. His voice was hoarse. "To be buried with his fellows in consecrated ground." "Sergei will say prayers for his soul," said Vasya. Her voice was as rough as his, with shouting and with weeping. She pressed the heels of her hands to her eyes. "He wandered the whole of this land," she said. "He knew it, and he loved it. And now he will be bone, trapped in frozen earth." "But there will be songs," said Dmitri. "I swear it. He will not be forgotten." Vasya said nothing at all. She had no words. What did songs matter? They would not bring her brother back. It was night when the cart came to take her brother's body away. It came rumbling out of the dark, accompanied by a spill of noise and light, and Dmitri's noisy attendants, all full of triumph, barely leavened by respect for the occasion. Vasya could not stand their noise or their joy, and anyway, Sasha was gone. She kissed her brother's forehead and rose and slipped away into the dark. She did not know when Morozko and Medved appeared. She had the sense that she'd been walking alone a long time, with no notion of where she was or where she was going. She just wanted to get away from the noise and stink, the gore and the grief, the wild triumph. But at some point, she raised her head and found them walking beside her. The two brothers she had met in a clearing as a child, the two that had marked her life and changed it. They were both daubed with blood, the bear's eyes alight with the remnants of battle lust, Morozko grave, his face unreadable. The enmity between them was still there, but changed somehow, transmuted. "It's because they aren't on opposite sides anymore," she thought, dim with exhausted grief. "God help me. They are both mine." Morozko spoke first, not to Vasya, but to his brother. "You still owe me a life," he said. The bear snorted. "I have tried to pay it. I offered her hers. I offered her brother his. Is it my fault that men and women are fools?" "Perhaps not," said Morozko. "But you still owe me a life." The bear looked surly. "Very well," he said. "What life?" Morozko turned to Vasya, looked a question. She only stared at him blankly. What life? Her brother was gone, and the field was thick with dead. Whose life could she desire now? Morozko reached very carefully into his sleeve, drew out something wrapped in embroidered cloth. He unwrapped it, held it out with both hands to Vasya. It was a dead nightingale, its body stiff and perfect, kept in violet with the water of life. It looked like the carved one she had kept with her through all the long nights and hard days. She stared from the bird to the Winter King, beyond speech. "Is it possible?" she whispered. Her throat was dust dry. "Perhaps," said Morozko, and turned back to his brother. She could not bear to watch. She could not bear to listen. She walked away from them, almost afraid of her hope, coming so soon after grief. She could not bear to see them succeed, and she could not bear to see them fail. Even when hoofbeats came softly up behind her, she didn't turn. Not until a soft nose came down lightly on her cheek. She turned her head and stared and stared, and she could not believe. She couldn't move. She couldn't speak. It was as though speech or movement would break the illusion, shatter it, and leave her desolate once more. She drank in the sight, his bay coat black in the darkness, the single star on his face, his warm dark eye. She knew him. She loved him. "Salafe," she whispered. "I was asleep," said the horse, "but those two, the bear and the winter king, they woke me up. I missed you." Her heart torn with exhaustion and shocked joy, Vasya threw her arms around the bay stallion's neck, and she wept. He was no ghost. He was warm, alive, smelling of himself, and the texture of his mane was agonizingly familiar against her cheek. "I will not leave you again," said the stallion, and put his head around to nuzzle her. "I missed you so," she said to the horse, hot tears sliding into his black mane. "I am sure of it," said Salove, nosing her. He shook his mane, looking superior. "But I am here now. You are the warden of the lake now. It has not had a mistress for a long time. I am glad it is you, but you should have had me. You would have done it all a great deal better if I'd been there." "I am sure of it," said Vasya, and she made a broken sound that was almost a laugh. Fingers tangled in her horse's mane, leaning on his broad, warm shoulder, she barely heard the bear speak.
"Well, this is all touching, but I am off. I have a world to see and her promise for my freedom, brother."
This last was added warily to Morozko. Vasya saw, when she opened her eyes, that the Winter King was eyeing his twin with undimmed suspicion. "You are still bound to me," said Vasya to the bear, "and to your promise. The dead will not rise."
"Men create enough chaos without me," said the bear. "I am just going to enjoy it. Perhaps give a few men nightmares."
"If you do worse," said Vasya, "the Cherti will tell me." She raised her golden wrists, a threat and a promise.
"I will not do worse."
"I will call you again," she said, "if there is need."
"So you will," he said. "I may even answer."
He bowed, and then he was gone, swiftly lost in the gloom. The battlefield was empty. The moon had risen, somewhere behind the clouds. The field was stiff with frost. The dead lay open-eyed, men and horses, and the living moved among them by torchlight, looking for dead friends or stealing what they could. Vasya looked away. The Cherti had already slipped away, back to their forests and streams, holding Dmitri's promise and Sergei's and Vasya's.
"We can share this land that we have kept."
Three Cherti remained. One was Morozko, standing silent. The second was a woman, whose dawn-pale hair slanted across the darkness of her skin. The third was a little mushroom spirit, who glowed a sickly green in the darkness. Vasya bowed to Dyatgrib and Polonochnitsa, straight-shouldered and solemn, though she knew her face was swollen and blotched like a child's with grief and with painful joy.
"My friends," she said, "you came back."
"You had your victory, lady," returned Midnight,
We are witnesses. You made your promises, and you kept them. We are yours in truth, the Certi. I came to tell you that the old woman, she is glad.
Vasya could only nod. What care had she for promises, either kept or broken? The price had been too high. But then she licked her lips and said, Tell my great-grandmother that I will come to her in midnight, if she will permit, for I have much to learn, and thank you, both of you, for your faith and your lessons.
Not tonight, put in Jadgrib in his high voice, practically. You aren't learning anything tonight. Go and find somewhere clean.
He fixed Morozko with a dark look.
Surely you know a good place, Winter King, even if your realm is too cold for mushrooms.
I know a place, said Morozko.
I will see you beside the lake in the moonlight, said Vasya to Dietgrib and Polunochnitsa.
We will wait for you there, said Midnight, and then she and Dietgrib were gone as suddenly as they'd appeared.
Vasya leaned against Salovey's shoulder, and the grief and the joy bewildered her equally. Morozko cupped his hands.
Let us go, he said, at last.
Without a word, she put a foot in his hands and let him boost her onto Salovey's back. She did not know where they were going, save that it was the direction her soul told her was away, away from the sound and the smell, the glory and the futility. Salovey carried her gently, neck arched, and Pozhar, glowing in the darkness, shed heat upon them both. Finally, they crested a small rise. The whole blood-drenched battlefield lay clear at their feet. Vasya dismounted and went to Pozhar.
Thank you, lady, she said. Will you fly free now, as you have long wished to do?
Pozhar lifted her head aloof, and her nostrils flared, as if to test the winds of heaven. But then she bent her golden head delicately and lipped Vasya's hair.
I will be at the lake when you return, she said. You may prepare a warm place for me on stormy nights and comb my mane.
Vasya smiled. It will be done, she said. Pozhar slanted her ears back a fraction.
Do not neglect the lake, for it will always need a guardian.
I will guard it, said Vasya. And I will watch over my family. And I will ride the world in between times through the farthest countries of dark and day. It is enough for one life. She paused.
Thank you, she added to the mare. More than I can say.
Then she stepped back. The mare threw her head up, small flames licking at the edge of her mane. One ear slanted toward Salovey, perhaps with a touch of coquetry. He rumbled softly at her. Then the mare reared, up and up. Her wings flared, brighter than the pale morning sun, gilding all the snowflakes, making shadows of the whirling snow. Then the firebird soared aloft in a rush of glory. Men who watched from afar later told each other that they had seen a comet, a sign of God's blessing, flying between heaven and earth. Vasya watched Pozhar go, eyes fixed on the brightness, and only looked down when Salovey nudged her in the small of her back. She buried her face in her horse's mane, breathed the reassuring smell of him. He had none of Pozhar's alarming tang of smoke. She could even, for an instant, forget the smell of blood and filth, fire and iron. A coolness at her back, and she lifted her head and turned. Roscoe had dirt under his nails, a streak of soot on his cheek. The white mare behind him looked as weary as he, her proud head hanging low. She nuzzled Salovey, her colt, once, lightly. Morozko looked weary, as men are weary, at the end of long labor. His eyes searched her face. She took his hands in hers. "Will it be thus for you," she asked him, "so long as you live, to stand beside us and to grieve for us?"
"I don't know," he said. "Perhaps. But I think that I would rather feel pain than not feel anything at all. Perhaps I am grown mortal after all."
His tone was wry, but then his arm closed around her tightly, and she put her arms around his neck and pressed her face to his shoulder. He smelled of earth and blood and fear, of that day's slaughter. But beneath, as always, were the scents of cold water and of pine. She tilted her head up and pulled him down to her and kissed him fiercely, as though at last she could lose herself, forget duty and that day's horror in the touch of his hands.
"Asya," he said low in her ear, "it is almost midnight. Where do you wish to go?"
His hand was in the snarls of her hair. "Somewhere with clean water," she said. "I am sick to death of blood."
"And then?"
"North. To tell Olya how..." She trailed off, had to steady her voice before she continued. "Perhaps after we may ride to the sea together and see the light on the water."
"Yes," he said.
She almost smiled. "And then?" "Well, you have a realm in the winter forest, and I have mine, on the bow curve of a lake. Perhaps we might forge one country in secret, a country of shadows, behind and beneath Dmitri's Russia. For there must always be a land for Cherti, for witches and for sorcerers, and for followers of the forest."
"Yes," he said again. "But for tonight,
food and cool air, clean water and untainted earth.
Come with me, Snyegurochka. I know a house in the winter forest."
"I know," she said, and a thumb brushed away her tears. She would have said she was too tired to vault to Solovey's back, but her body did it despite her.
"What did we gain?"
Vasya asked Morozko as they rode away. The snow had stopped. The sky shone clear. The season of frost had barely begun.
"A future," returned the frost demon. "For men will say in later years that this was the battle that made Rus a nation of one people, and Cherti will live on unfaded."
"Even for that, the price was very high," she said. They were riding knee to knee. He made no answer. The wild darkness of midnight was all about them now. But somewhere ahead, a light shone through the trees. Author's note. Almost from the earliest days of drafting The Bear and the Nightingale, I knew I wanted to end my trilogy at the Battle of Kulikova. This battle always seemed to me to create a natural point of reconciliation for many of the conflicts I wished to consider on the pages of these three books. The Rus against the Tatars, Christian against pagan, Vasya trying to balance her own desires and ambitions with the needs of her family and her nation. The path I charted to get to the battle has varied wildly since those early days, but the destination never changed. The Battle of Kulikova really happened. In 1380, on the Don River, Grand Prince Dmitry Ivanovich acquired his historical moniker, Donskoy, of the Don, by leading a combined force from several different Russian principalities against a host commanded by the Tatar Temnik Mamai. Dmitry won. It was the first time the Russian people combined under the leadership of Moscow to defeat a foreign adversary. Some have argued that this event marks the spiritual birth of the nation of Russia. I have chosen to take it as such, although in reality, the historical significance of this battle is the subject of ongoing debate. Who, if not the novelist, has the right to cherry-pick historical interpretations that suit her best? My fairy tale version of this battle ignores the incredible amount of political and military maneuvering that led up to the event itself, the threats, the skirmishes, the deaths, the marriages, the delays. But the great events of my version of Kulikova are drawn from history. A warrior monk named Alexander Peresviet really fought in single combat with a Tatar warrior named Chelubey and died victorious. Dmitri really did trade places with one of his minor boyars so that he could fight with his men, unmarked by the enemy. Oleg of Ryazan really did play an ambiguous role in the battle. Perhaps he betrayed the Russians. Perhaps he betrayed the Tatars. Perhaps he merely strove to chart a path between the two. All that is true. And perhaps, beneath the battle recorded by history, there was fought another, between holy men and Cherti, over how they were to coexist in this land of theirs. Who knows? But the concept of dvoyeverie, dual faith, persisted in Russia up until the revolution. Orthodoxy coexisted with paganism in peace. Who is to say that wasn't the work of a girl with strange gifts and green eyes? Who is to say, in the end, that the three guardians of Russia are not a witch, a frost demon, and a chaos spirit? I find it fitting. Thank you for reading all the way to the end. I started the series in a tent on a beach in Hawaii when I was 23 years old, and now you are holding the final piece of that work in your hands. I am still astonished by the journey and more grateful than I can say that it happened. A note on Russian names. Russian conventions of naming and address, while not as complicated as the consonant clusters would suggest, are so different from English forms that they merit explanation. Modern Russian names can be divided into three parts: the first name, the patronymic, and the last, or family name. In medieval Rus, people generally had only a first name, or, among the highborn, a first name and a patronymic. First names and nicknames. Russian is extremely rich in diminutives. Any Russian first name can give rise to a large number of nicknames. The name Yekaterina, for example, can be shortened into Katerina, Katya, Katyusha, or Katenka, among other forms. These variations are often used interchangeably to refer to a single individual, according to the speaker's degree of familiarity and the whims of the moment. Alexander, Sasha, Dmitri, Mitya, Vasilisa, Vasya, Vasochka, Rodion, Rodya, Yekaterina, Katya, Katyusha. Patronymic. The Russian patronymic is always derived from the first name of an individual's father. It varies according to gender. For example, Vasilisa's father is named Pyotr. Her patronymic, derived from her father's name, is Petrovna. Her brother Alexei uses the masculine form, Petrovich. To indicate respect in Russian, you do not use Mr. or Mrs. as in English. Rather, you address someone by first name and patronymic together. A stranger meeting Vasilisa for the first time would call her Vasilisa Petrovna. When Vasilisa is masquerading as a boy, she calls herself Vasily Petrovich. When a high-born woman married, in medieval Rus, she would exchange her patronymic, if she had one, for a name derived from her husband's name. Thus, Olga, who was Olga Petrovna as a girl, has become Olga Vladimirova, whereas Olga and Vladimir's daughter is called Maria Vladimirovna. This is Kathleen Gatti. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Winter of the Witch, Book 3 of the Winter Night Trilogy by Catherine Arden. This program was directed by Bruce Mann. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2019 by Katherine Arden.